Brother Steve, and good morning, my dearly loved brethren and sisters in our Lord Jesus Christ. Well, our daily readings have brought us this morning in the Psalms to this most glorious little composition of the sons of Korah. And what an inspiration and encouragement it is to all of us. But, brethren and sisters, more than that, it's probably also a very great challenge to us as we come to grips with the spirit of the son of Korah who wrote this and for those who sung it in the temple services. And I think, brothers and sisters, as we focus our minds upon this for a moment this morning, we'll find it helpful as we prepare to meet in the presence of our Lord in remembrance of him. Because here embedded is not just the spirit of the sons of Korah, but a greater than they, the spirit of our Lord himself. Well, the superscription tells us that it was a psalm for the sons of Korah. That's what the authorized version says, but in the margin it says of. And there's been much dispute as to whether it's of or for. And probably in a sense it's both. The Hebraist Thurtle once wrote that it's beyond any question in his mind that authorship was intended in phrases like a psalm for David or of David or for the sons of Korah or of Asaph. He said it was beyond question as far as he was concerned that authorship was intended. But it was almost certainly put into the hands of the sons of Korah as a community in their role in the temple services and sung by them for generation upon generation thereafter. And it's an amazing little psalm, particularly this one out of all of the sons of Korah, because it has stamped upon it the characteristics of this amazingly faithful family in the midst of the nation. Perhaps the most obvious stamp that stands out to us all is verse 10, where there's this allusion about whether they'd rather be in the tents of wickedness or in the house of God. And we know that the sons of Korah, having made that decision, ended up in the house of God, in ministering to God, and left the tents of wickedness where their father was. But there's more than that, because there's this constant mention, particularly in the early part of this psalm, to the tabernacle, to the courts, the altars, the house. It is where their focus was. That this, as a group of Levites, this was their focus. And here is the flavour of their life, so to speak. The clear focus of their devoted service was around the temple in a number of ways, not only as singers, but as gatekeepers and in other roles. You know, back in the time of number 16, when the issue of Korah, Dathan, and Abiram was plaguing the nation and this rebellion was rising, when it finally came to a head, Korah was challenged, and Moses said unto Korah at that time, he said, "The God of Israel has separated you to bring you near to himself to do the service of the tabernacle." And Korah and his associates had made light of that. God had called them and separated them to bring them near to himself. And Korah despised that role and wanted preeminence instead of it. But we find that his sons, who now become a force within the nation for hundreds of years, were content to see the incredible privilege that there was in being drawn nigh to God. In fact, God chose them through David and brought them right into the very centre of temple worship. The closeness to God in terms of the worship was almost second to none amongst the Levites. And while Korah, in his tents of wickedness and just focused on himself, here is his sons as a group later who were prepared to focus on the majesty and the, the glory of God, the beauty of his house, and all that that stood for. And the psalm breathes that spirit, doesn't it? Just as we read it, it's uplifting because we see this wonderful breath of fresh air coming from these faithful servants, the sons of Korah. It was truly a very faithful family for a very long time. We've just caught that spirit in that hymn that we've just sung, because the hymn that we just sung was based on Psalm 42 and 43, which was another of the songs of the sons of Korah. And you may have noticed there that there's even much very similar language. In fact, if you glance your eye, if you've got an Oxford Bible or a Bible with a margin, you just glance your eye down the centre margin, you'll see a number of allusions to Psalm 43 and Psalm 42 picked up here in Isaiah in Psalm 84. Because the language was the same. It was the language of this family. It was not just an isolated spirit. This was the spirit of this family, and they passed it from generation to generation for hundreds of years. Well, in terms of laying a background, and it's often useful to find a background for a psalm, and I think in this particular case, trying to find a specific background is difficult and probably not very rewarding. But there is a setting, and it's very simple, and it lay in the mere circumstances of the Levite organization under David. You remember David under the following his discussions earlier with Samuel, and under inspiration, he laid out the organization of temple worship, and the Levites in particular, and the Korahites included in that, were divided into courses and required to perform their duties in rotation. Now, we find from 1 Chronicles 9 and elsewhere that in actual fact the Levites, many of them didn't actually reside in Jerusalem. It says specifically they were in their villages, and from time to time they came up. They stayed in their villages, and they did not come, reside in and around the temple or near Jerusalem all the time. And so what we've got here, brothers and sisters, I think, in Psalm 84, is a son of Korah who pens this, because much of this is written in the first person, but it encapsulates the spirit of many of that in that family, and later became the spirit of them because it was passed and sung from generation to generation, so that even future generations that hadn't even known who the writer was, and we don't know who he was either, would have catched this same basic spirit. But we have here this heartfelt desire and yearning as this son of Korah, this Levite, just waited his turn to come to the temple to serve. It's just such a beautiful thing. He's waiting in his village, just waiting for the day when next, it might have only been a week or a month before he was actually going to be able to do that, but within him there was this longing, this languishing, because he just wanted to be there, right in the midst where the service of God was going on. And so it begins, "How amiable thy tabernacles," or perhaps more understandable to us and perhaps a little more meaningful, "How lovely are thy habitations," or "thy dwelling places, O Yahweh of hosts." How lovely are they? Because he goes on to say, "My soul longs, yea, even faints for the courts of Yahweh. My heart and my flesh cry out for the living God." Now that's an intense, intense language, isn't it, brothers and sisters? Reflecting some very strong feeling and emotion. This is not just poetry. In fact, whenever we come across language in the Psalms, we can rest assured that the Psalms are an expression of deep and inner emotion because of just the way they were composed and what they were used for as songs. They weren't just composed as nice words that all sounded well. They were, in fact, the intense experiences, sometimes with godly men, you know, going through deep depression, other times on great euphoric highs. But here, we actually have this intense longing, this emotion that this Levite wanted to be where God was and where God dwelt. And the word long there just means to grow pale and faint, means to languish. You know, this is intense, isn't it? Because it was physically affecting him. He so desired this so much to be right in the center. And it was only that he had to wait for his turn to come around before he was appointed to go up to Jerusalem. But it involved everything about him. Did you notice in verse 2? His soul faints, his heart and his flesh cries out. Heart, soul and body. This isn't just words. This is the whole person's involved in this. You remember, Francis, when we cast our mind back to the inauguration of the nation when Israel gathered at Sinai after they had been redeemed through the Red Sea. They came to Sinai and there God said through Moses, I want you to make me a sanctuary that I may dwell among them. And so when it came to the time with the pattern that Moses was given to build the tabernacle was put right in the very center of an organized camp so that the whole nation might focus their attention on God. It was God's intent that sanctuary might be right in the middle so that the whole nation, every day of their lives, might learn to look to him. You know, most of the nation actually missed that. They missed the significant point, and Korah did. Korah was one of the closest into those to where the tabernacle actually was. But here we've got a spirit of a group of the descendants of Korah who had come to love Yahweh with all their heart and all their soul and all their might. That's what verse 2 is saying to us, brethren and sisters. That's the spirit of this man that's writing this. It's a living example of the very first commandment in Deuteronomy 6, isn't it? But you know what Deuteronomy 6 goes on to say immediately after that, when Moses telling the people at the end of the wilderness wanderings exactly what God was looking for? He wanted them to love him with all their heart, soul and mind. The very, very next thing that he goes on to say, and I want you diligently to teach this to your children. And for hundreds and hundreds of years, the sons of Korah maintained that spirit where their entire being, their whole life was wrapped up in a focus just where God had always intended it to be. They saw the tabernacle as representative of the place where God was. They saw the courts and the altars not as just mere entities in themselves, but as a place where God dwelt, as a place where they wanted themselves to be, and not just for a short time in their service rotation. They wanted to be there all the time. And so we find this beautiful reminiscence of the psalmist in verse 3. You know, it's interesting because it must be a result, verse 3, must be a result of a person who had actually been around and in the tabernacle or the temple. Because he says here, and yea, the sparrow hath found an house, and the swallow a nest for herself, where she may lay her young. Even thine altars, O Yahweh of hosts, my King and my God. Blessed are they that dwell in thy house. They will be still praising thee. So the psalmist, in reflecting the times when he was in the temple, had seen these tiny birds. One of them a migratory bird, one of them an indigenous bird. It didn't matter whether they came from far or near. These birds, tiny as they were, had found a refuge, had found a place of safety. They'd found, more importantly, as far as he was concerned, he'd noticed they'd found a place of dwelling in the house of God, just where he himself would wanted to be. He wanted so much to have that permanence near God, and yet here he envied the little birds who flew around and were able to make a place that was near God. Now, of course, the birds were not going to honour God in the same way that he could if he was there, but it's interesting that he even saw that He noticed it. He noticed that even those little creatures were closer to God or in a place where he himself would like to have been. And so the refrain in verse 4, blessed indeed are they that dwell in thy house. They shall ever be singing thy praise, as the RSV and ESV actually have that last phrase. They shall ever be singing thy praise. And that's, in fact, where the spirit of this son of Korah goes. It was this intense desire to be with God and to be in a situation where he could ever sing the praises of God. You know, brothers and sisters, clearly he wasn't talking about just being literally in the courts and in the house of God. They were evidently symbolic from what verse 2 and 3 tell us. There is a very personal connection here in the words of the psalmist to God himself, whom he calls the living God and my King and my God in verse 3. He wanted to be there because God was there. That was the real essence of it. He wanted to be there because God was there in the centre. You know, David had exactly the same spirit as this. Just turn back a few pages to Psalm 27. We know these words really well, I'm sure, but it's a kindred spirit that this family had with the man after God's own heart. Where David says in verse 4, one thing have I desired of Yahweh, that will I seek after, that I may dwell in the house of Yahweh all the days of my life, to behold the beauty of Yahweh and to inquire in his temple. That he may dwell. That's exactly what the son of Korah wanted. But you see, brothers and sisters, he wanted it for exactly the same reason that David did too. See what David says there in verse 4? He wanted to behold the beauty of Yahweh. He wanted there, in the midst of where God had set himself and set his name, to contemplate through all the symbol what the wonderful character of God was like. Just look at the psalm before that, Psalm 26. Another psalm of David. And here David says in verse 8, Yahweh, I have loved the habitation of thy house, the place where thine honour dwelleth. That's what David saw, and it's what the sons of Korah saw in the house. It's why they wanted to be there, because there God's honour dwelled. God's honour. This was not a theoretical thing. It wasn't just a matter of words for David or for the sons of Korah. There was something there that really drew them and deeply moved them that they just wanted to hang on to. But you see, David actually helps us illustrate just exactly what the sons of Korah were looking for here, because if you go back to verse 3 of Psalm 26, David says, for thy loving kindness is before mine eyes, and I have walked in thy truth. Verse 5, I have hated the congregation of evildoers. I will not sit with the wicked. Verse 6, I will wash my hands in innocency. So will I compass thine order. You see, brothers and sisters, for David, being and loving the habitation of God's house and where his honour dwelt meant for him that he was adopting the very characteristics that he saw in all of God's appointments. He saw God's loving kindness illustrated, and he himself tried to emulate that. He saw the evil shunned out of God's house, and he wanted to push that out of his life and would not sit with innocent men. He tried to wash his hands with innocency before he came before the altar. His whole life was in tune, and that's what loving the house of God was about. It was actually a desire to be in harmony with God, because that's where God dwelt, and he couldn't be in the house of God and be out of harmony with God. So loving the habitation of God was hating evil and loving righteousness in practice, a life in conformity with all those principles. You know, this is an inspiration, isn't it? The spirit of the sons of Korah and of this particular author that wrote this psalm in the first place is an inspiration to us. But By the same token, brethren and sisters, I find that a challenge as well. Because we got the spirit of this son of Korah, who longed and fainted that he might, and his soul crying out for the living God. You notice back in Psalm 84, at the end of verse 4, having reached this climax, he just tells us to stop and think. Don't just walk on as if, oh yes, that's very nice sounding words, lovely poetry, a nice song, now what's next? No, he tells us to stop and think. Stop and think, because here was a spirit that we all need to have. It's a challenge, isn't it, brothers and sisters? To think if we have this same intense longing for the courts of Yahweh, to be where God actually is, to love what he loves, and to be there every day, all day, brothers and sisters. That's what the spirit of this psalmist is about. Is that the spirit that we have, that we find in our hearts of wanting to come here this morning? And is the spirit the same as the sons of Korah in anticipating with great eagerness the service and opportunity to give in the house of God? Is that our spirit? I can't say I'm always like that, brothers and sisters, and I'm sure you'd find at times that we have to lift ourselves to get into this frame of mind. And perhaps too for the sons of Korah, they themselves went through times of waning, and so it was encapsulated here as a family characteristic, not just of the sons of Korah, but of all the nation that were going to hear these praises. You know, the Psalms, brothers and sisters, often reveal a great deal more when we dig a little deeper about the relationship of the author and his God, and hence about our relationship to God. And I think there's even more embedded in these first few verses than meets the eye. Did you notice the relationship that this son of Korah has with God? He says, as he cries out, "How wonderful, how beautiful are your dwelling places," he calls God Yahweh of hosts. And he does again in verse 3, and even again later, four times in this psalm. He comes in verse 2 and cries out for the living ale. A little phrase, brothers and sisters, that only ever occurs once else in the Psalms, and it's again in the mouth of the sons of Korah. And he tells us in verse 3 that Yahweh of hosts is my king and my God. It tells us about his relationship. You know, how do we think about God, brothers and sisters? How do you think about God? Or how do you address him? Just to take that first little phrase that we can read straight over quite easily, because often we just read and don't take much notice of the incredible care that the psalmist or the writers under inspiration have used to pen and use titles about God that are just so amazing. Yahweh of hosts, for example, is that an unusual? Would you have expected that to have been a phrase that he would have used in terms of how wonderful are God's dwelling places? You know, the very first usage of that term in the Bible, brothers and sisters, comes in the mouth of a son of Korah. The very first time we ever read it, it was in relationship to a son of Korah. It was in relation to Elkanah. And it says of him that he went to sacrifice unto Yahweh of hosts in Shiloh, and the sons of Eli were there. That's what the verse says. But only a couple of verses later, we find it first used in a prayer. And whose prayer was that? It was in Hannah's prayer. The first person to call upon Yahweh of hosts as a title in prayer that's recorded for us. And she there says, O Yahweh of hosts, if thou wilt indeed look upon the affliction of thine handmaid and give me a son, then I will give him back to you, that he might be dedicated to you forever. You know, it's not used very frequently, in all of that time from the first of Samuel through to the Psalms. And then we find it popping up in Psalm 46, Psalm 48, Psalm 84, all songs of the sons of Korah. It does occur in David's mouth as well, because David had a kindred spirit with these men. But then we find the prophets starting to take it up, Isaiah and Jeremiah, and particularly those prophets after the exile, where they use this title, you know, over and over again. And what we find, brothers and sisters, when we do a quick cursory glance across the scriptures and the prophets in particular, we find that it's Yahweh of hosts that is said to dwell between the cherubim above the mercy seat. It's Yahweh of hosts that's dwelling there. And do you think that the sons of Korah did not understand that? We're told, brothers and sisters, that Yahweh of hosts dwells in Zion, not Jerusalem, in Zion. And in fact, the prophets go forward through to the time of the kingdom and they say, Yahweh of hosts will reign victoriously in Zion. So it encapsulates Yahweh's avowed purpose to manifest himself in a host of faithful ones and to reign. And even now, that host of heaven ensures that purpose. It's a guarantee that that will finally be fulfilled. And so we have, you know, Elkanah and Hannah seeing that principle. David saw it because David said in Psalm 24, when he's seeing the glory of Yahweh come in finally to his house, and he says, open the gates, and who will come in? Yahweh of hosts will come in through the gates that have been opened. The prophet saw it and rejoiced. Here, son of Korah saw all that and longed for the habitation of Yahweh of hosts. He understood that he wasn't just looking at a dwelling place now, but a dwelling place in the future. He saw that there was going to be a day when a great multitude would be gathered into that place that he was setting his heart on now, and that despite all current appearances, God would manifest himself in an innumerable host that was symbolized by just this humble house that he desired to be in. But what about us, brothers and sisters? We don't have a temple like the sons of Korah to desire to go to. For us, there is no literal house. And since the times of the New Testament, we know very clearly that the house of God is the ecclesia. In fact, Paul even uses the language of Psalm 84 in the New Testament about the ecclesia. Did you know that? He says, for example, in 2 Corinthians chapter 6, ye are the temple of what? The living God. The only place the phrase living God occurs in the whole of the Psalms is here and in Psalm 42 or 43. And it's picked up by Paul. And he says, I will dwell in them and walk in them, and I will be their God, and they shall be my people. This was what the symbol of the temple and the tabernacle, the dwelling places of God, really pointed forward to. And Paul lifts it right out of the context of the words of the sons of Korah. Just let's go to 2 Timothy 3 just for a moment. You probably know these words well, but I think it's just worth us for a moment just contemplating how important this is to have a longing for the house of God, and for us what the house of God might represent. Not only a place where God dwells, but more than that. In 1 Timothy 3, verse 15, where he says, and if I tarry long, that thou mayest know how thou oughtest to behave thyself in the house of God, which is the ecclesia of living God. We've got that same phrase again. The ecclesia of God who's alive. It's the very same power in the life of the sons of Korah that they saw as real and living every day. But you know, brothers and sisters, he goes on to say, and this is the pillar and ground of the truth, but but what does this mean for us? You know, if the sons of Korah had this intense longing and desire, what does it mean when we translate this into a figurative house made of people that's being developed now? Well, verse 16 tells us, "And without controversy, great is the mystery of godliness. God was manifest in the flesh, justified in the spirit, seen of angels, preached unto the Gentiles, believed on in the world, and received up into glory." You see, when the sons of Korah longed to find the living God, they were anticipating, brothers and sisters, a glorious ultimate outworking that Paul talks about here. The outworking of God being manifest through the flesh, justified in spirit, seen of angels, preached to the Gentile, and finally manifest in an immense multitude of individuals of which the ecclesia was the pillar and ground. So what about feeling towards the ecclesia, brothers and sisters, if it's God's house? Is this the place where we want to be? Is it a place where we long to be with the spirit of Korah's sons? Where we desire to serve, and we desire to praise, and we desire to be forever. Oh, we know that in this life and in this dispensation, it's all too easy to see the faults in ecclesias. It's so easy for us to focus on the things that are wrong that someone's done or said in weakness. And we fail to focus on the fact that this is where God is at work. The sons of Korah could have found plenty wrong with temple worship, but it didn't stop their intense longing, because they saw that symbol as the very essence of where they wanted to be and where God was working. They knew he was working there. And so for us, it should be exactly the same. You know, Paul, brothers and sisters, saw the ecclesia in an amazing light. And you know, as you're doing the readings from here in the next few months, and we turn occasionally through the gospel records and back into the epistles, just take yourself the chance to look at how Paul saw the ecclesia, and you'll find this amazing desire he had. It was his heart's desire to be with his brethren and to build them up and to encourage them, because he saw in the midst God at work. He didn't see the weaknesses of individuals. He saw God at work. And so he longed to be there because God was working there. And so ought our desire to be just like that as well. We'll come back for a moment to Psalm 84. Because we find here that the psalmist, having told us about his intense desire to be in the house of God, where God was really dwelling, he switches slightly, but with a clear connection. Because when we read verse 5, it says, "Blessed is the man whose strength is in he, and in whose heart are the ways of them." And there's an immediate connection, even though there's a pause at the end of verse 4, there's an immediate connection with verses 4 and 5 because of the blessing. He's just ended up saying, "Blessed are they that dwell in thy house." But now goes on to say, "Well, blessed too is a man whose strength is in thee." You know, when you think about that, though the psalmist is broadening the thought, he's continuing the thought of this blessing. In fact, he's really saying, I believe, that first and second blessing are really the same. "Blessed are they that dwell in thy house." That's true. But blessed is the man whose strength is in thee. Because the only people who ever would have wanted to dwell in the house of God were those whose strength was in him. And now he's saying, it doesn't matter whether you can actually get to the house. It doesn't matter whether you are physically there, like he was not being able to be there all the time. This blessing can still continue. This state of joy and happiness is with a man whose strength is in God, in whose ways, he says, are the, sorry, in whose heart are the ways of them. It's a bit of a funny phrase there, in whose ways are the, in whose heart are the ways of them. And the RSV and the ESV translate that last phrase, in whose heart are the highways to Zion. Because most of the nation, including many of the Levites, could not permanently be in a house. They couldn't. And though it was this Levite's desire to be there all the time, there was a blessing for those whose strength was in God and in whose heart were the pathways or the highways to Zion. Because if a person had beaten a path in their mind to Zion, a path of holy and godly living, a path that led to righteousness and truth, a path that brought them into justice and a love for mercy, that mental pathway would lead them to Zion, where Yahweh was and where Yahweh would reign. And there is a vision of their ultimate destination in their minds. And it mattered not where they were in time or space. They could be there with God in thought if only they put in their heart the highways to Zion. And so he says, blessed indeed is a man like that. He's as blessed as a man who's right alongside of God in the house. You know, brothers and sisters, we know that if we're not in the house, and if we're separated from where God and where his people and where his worship are, it's difficult, isn't it? Life is difficult for us. So what he goes on to say, verse 6, because those people were passing through the valley of Baca. Notice in the margin it says mulberry trees. It's variously rendered, and it comes from a word that has a meaning, though it can mean trees, certain kinds of trees. It has the idea of weeping, from some of the balsam trees that actually wept when they were cut. Through the valley of weeping. And perhaps now, brothers and sisters, even this man or others from any generation who put their strength and in God found themselves passing through a valley of weeping. The experiences of adversity and depression and sorrow can sometimes press upon us, brethren and sisters, and it may well be that some of us have come here this morning through the valley with a desire to enliven in our hearts the way to Zion. Well, look at what the psalmist says. Who, he says, though passing through the valley of Baca, make it a well. Make it a well, or a place of springs, as the RSV says. You know, it's only possible to make the valley of weeping a place of springs of life and joy and refreshment if, in fact, we have in our hearts got the ways to Zion firmly entrenched. But it is possible, brothers and sisters, and we know from experience, many of us, that is true. It's true to our own experience. If only we put our strength in him and write into our hearts the ways, the highway to Zion, it doesn't matter where we're passing. We can transform the present into a place of springs, of refreshing water. And not only that, brothers and sisters, he goes on to say, and the rain also filleth the pools. You know, rain was not in the control of anyone in the nation. That wasn't for man to control. That was God at work And the rain, as we know, is a symbol very often of the blessing of God. And so the psalmist is saying here, if you're passing through that valley on your journey to find God in Zion, if you have the spirit of the ways of Zion in your heart, then you'll be able to make the sorrow and weeping a place of rejoicing and springs. And then God himself will add on top of that. See, he says, the rain also filleth the pools. That's God's work. God is able to add his part and lift the burden and relieve the trouble in his time. Now, there's great encouragement here, isn't there, from a son of Korah who himself was separated from God and yet going through the valley of Baca was able to transform the present into something that was glorious. And verse 7 goes on to say, and they go from strength to strength. You know, that's counterintuitive, isn't it, brothers and sisters? It's against all odds. When you're in a long journey and you're going somewhere, you don't get stronger and stronger the closer you get to the end. You get weaker and weaker. But here on this journey going through the highways to Zion, which is a mental journey that's going to bring us to Zion, there is strength built upon strength upon strength that's not ours but God's. Because in our natural circumstances, we would only get weaker and weaker. It's just an evidence, again, of God at work. And what an amazing little phrase that is at the end of verse 7. Grab hold of it, brethren and sisters. Because he then says, and every one of them in Zion appeareth before God. Every one appears before God. And here's the great desire of the lives of all the faithful, to appear before God, to come into his presence, and to be in Zion with him as part of Yahweh of hosts in that incredible day when he will join all together. What an amazing encouragement that is from this psalmist who says, every one of them, every one, no exceptions, will be there and will appear before God in Zion. If only we can make God our strength and put in our hearts the ways to Zion and the desire to be there, brethren and sisters. But therein lies the challenge for us, doesn't it? The promise is there. The promise is there that we'll be able to transform this present experiences to a blessing, and that God will add his own blessing in time, and that finally he will bring us, every one of us, to the hill of Zion. The only challenge is, can we put in our hearts the highways to Zion? You know, our minds, aren't they, brothers and sisters, are so easily filled with highways to other places. There are so many vain and useless things that cross our paths that sometimes grab our minds for a time, that perhaps even become dreams and hopes and wants when they should. So the challenge to us is to write in our hearts the highway to Zion, to beat that path and encourage it in our families, because there alone at the end of that is a true and lasting treasure that God guarantees that he will bring to every single one who has that desire and writes that in their heart. But Psalm's going on and up and ends with a prayer. Verse 8, O Yahweh Elohim of hosts, hear my prayer. Give ear, O God of Jacob. Again, we've got an illustration of the relationship that this son of Korah had with God. He has evidently meditated at length about who God is and how he works. particularly in the lives of individuals. And he calls upon the God of Jacob now to give ear. The God of Jacob, brothers and sisters, he hasn't related anything to Jacob to this point, and yet here, as he contemplates this journey to Zion, he calls upon the God of Jacob, conjuring a picture in his mind, no doubt, of the overshadowing care of the one who will deliver those who trust in him, those who break their own self-trust, their reliance in their own ability to work things through and to trust in God, that put God as their strength. And through the angel that redeemed Jacob from all evil, so in the mind of the psalmist, he wants the same God to hear, the same God who will send his angel to deliver from times of trouble and to encourage in times that are low. But he doesn't stop there, brothers and sisters. Verse 9, "Behold, O God, our shield." Again, his mind's gone back to the times of Abraham. Abraham used that phrase of God, his shield, an exceeding great reward. So he's contemplating the trust that Abraham had in the Almighty. You see, brothers and sisters, to the psalmist now, this is turning into the central core of what our lives have to be about. And it's where he ends this psalm. It's where he's building to. Because he then pleads in verse 9 to look upon the face of thine anointed one. And God has, brothers and sisters, looked upon the face of his anointed one. And because he has looked upon him with favour and has elevated and exalted him to a name above all, we ourselves have hope and have come here this morning to place our faces towards him. Not because we have anything that's worthy for him to look to, but desiring to see in him our support and our saviour. No, we see in him too, brothers and sisters, the very epitome of all that verses 5 to 7 said. Did you notice when verse 5 began, it said, "Blessed is the man, not just those"? And prophetically, it's not only talking generally, but it's prophetically talking of the man whose strength is in thee, who truly every day of his life had the ways of Zion, the highways to Zion, passing through his mind, who passed through the most severe of the valleys of Baca and transformed them before him and went on from strength to strength to appear before God. You know, the one that we've come to remember, brothers and sisters, is here prophetically in this psalm. It's what the psalmist is really putting before us as the example for us to go on and follow. It has brought our hearts to the same desire as he himself had had. For he goes on to say in verse 10, "For a day in thy courts is better than 1,000 elsewhere. And I'd rather be a doorkeeper in the house of my God than to dwell in the tents of wickedness." You know, there's a clear allusion there to the choice that the sons of Korah made. Brothers and sisters, but you know, actually, the word doorkeeper doesn't actually occur in the Hebrew there. The word is probably that the margin translates it more literally and says, "I would choose rather to sit at the threshold." Now, it's true that the sons of Korah, not immediately, but later in the times of David, were given the role of doorkeepers and to keep the threshold. But in fact, I think what the psalmist is saying, that is, a son of Korah who understands that strength is not in him, he's not relying in a position that David's given, he's saying that he desires to be in God's court so much that he would even just desire to sit at the threshold for him in a lowly position, not the exalted position of doorkeeper that David had given him. He was given that because of his faithfulness, but he would rather even be just able to come close to the house of God than to be in the tents of wickedness. Shows us the spirit of this whole family and of this man as he saw it, because he'd learned to put his trust in God and not in man. Verse 11, For Yahweh Elohim is a sun and a shield. Yahweh will give grace and glory. No good thing will he withhold from them that walk uprightly. And true it is, brethren and sisters, that this morning we've come to receive the healing rays of the sun in the face of Jesus Christ. Because as Paul said in Corinthians, God has shined in our hearts to give the light of the glory of God in the face of Jesus Christ. And though we receive that, brethren and sisters, we receive the enlightenment and we receive grace through him, yet it is his avowed intention to lift all the sons who come and follow him to glory in the future. An amazing little psalm, isn't it, brethren and sisters? And so with this confidence and the encouragement that's inspired by this son of Korah and the whole group of that family who sang these words for centuries, let us, with renewed energy and confidence, pursue our journey design amidst whatever God brings for us now, confident that his blessing and his care and his grace will be with us as we go from strength to strength and come to realize the very climax of this little psalm in verse 12. O Yahweh of hosts, blessed truly is the man that trusts in thee.